phone while loud. So yeah, that's fine. Whatever it is.
We're good.
That's
We
cool.
starting now.
What happens?
We starting.
Okay, let me mute myself and then I'm gonna hit record too.
This call is being recorded.
Put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up?
Greetings. Welcome to another episode.
Baby, you understand me now.
You know
if
what?
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. Sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry, and then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. If I seem edgy, I want you to know I never mean to take it out on you. Life has its problems, and I get more than my share. But that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Like anyone,
Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul. I try so hard, so please don't let me be misunderstood.
Okay. Let's try this again. Welcome to another episode of Real Life, the radio show. I'm your host, Jenna Kepra, alongside my partner, Brother Roz. Today is May the 7th, 2019. Here on this Tuesday evening, how are you doing, Brother Roz?
Hey, man, I am doing good. I'm glad to be here with you and the other callers and listeners. And it's actually a good evening so far. So, yeah, I'm cool. How are you? Still learning, too.
Yes.
Can we add that?
I am still learning. Learning us some opportunities, actually. But very interesting in this transition in my life. These stages that we all are going through. You wanted to play Screaming Jay Hawkins. I put a spell on you, excuse me. And and I interrupted because Misunderstood come on. And I think both of those songs kind of sums up what we are going to discuss tonight. So, to get things started, let me go through a couple of articles that I found interesting in this show we have today, Things We Need to Know, Part 2, because we've done this before. So, I will start off with this video.
Commissioner of Agriculture Andy Gibson tells me Memphis Meats is a company based out of California, and they're changing the way food is grown, transitioning from the farm to a petri dish.
This summer, grocery stores across Mississippi will be selling an alternative meat product engineered from a company called Memphis Meats, and they're changing the way food is made.
They have perfected a program to cultivate, harvest animal cells, artificially feed them a high-protein slime, and grow that into a food product that they were trying to label as meat.
They're basically using the same kind of hormones that chickens normally produce to help grow, grow and develop, and just doing it in a petri dish.
Some state leaders call it unnatural. Cell biologists say it's an advanced step towards further genetic modification.
We're talking about science fiction type material, growing meat from a hair follicle of a cow.
Seemed like it was kind of a science fiction type kind of thought in the past, but you know, technology has gotten so much now that we're able to do this relatively, I guess, easily. I mean, there's still a lot of hurdles that the company's going to have to go through.
One is the cost of the product.
First hamburger that was grown in a petri dish was like $330,000 or something like that. It's ridiculous.
Agriculture Commissioner Andy Gibson says another hurdle is the truth in labeling law. Missouri and Mississippi are the only states regulating the product in this way.
Come July 1, we're going to make sure every product in our grocery stores across the great state of Mississippi, if meat is being sold, that in fact it's real meat. And if it's not meat, they can't call it meat.
We reached out to Memphis Meats to learn more about their product. We haven't heard back. Jennifer Lott, 16 WAPT News.
Oh, man. Now, we have discussed this and talked about how they was going to try to slide this into our consumer base. Initially, we was thinking it was going to come from the direction of Chinese, Japanese. And who's to say that this isn't? Because it's a lot of Asians down in Texas also.
Remember, they sell plastic rice and all kinds of stuff.
Yo.
So,
yeah, I mean, fitness. Like, you're right. Just post stuff in the water and pull stuff out. Like, you know, they got YouTube videos, hidden cameras, all of these things. But we discussed this, and I think we really need to get back to the Book Study Club, because Fantastic Voyage, this is a prime example of the things we were saying was going to come into play, trying to be passed in law.
Yep, I agree. And America is the main country, if not the only country, that has really no sanctions against GMO products being sold to its public, and the labeling of those products where the public may not be fully aware that something they're eating is genetically modified. Like, a lot of countries do not accept U.S. imports because of our use of genetically modified products. And that's just a fact. And I know just from traveling, when I'm just going to use this as an example. Let's take KFC. You eat KFC here, you're not eating real chicken. But if you go to Trinidad, they actually cook real chicken. So you taste what real chicken tastes like when you go to other places, you know, than when you actually eat what they serve here. So a lot of stuff is actually not real at all. And we're just not told it. And usually it has to be some investigative report that comes out, or some company does a clandestine test. They just buy like a McDonald's burger or a Wendy's burger, and then they find out that it got GMAT material in it. Like, if these are the ways that these things come out, it's never like where they're disclosing this stuff just immediately so that you know, hey, I want to be able to make a viable choice as to what I put in my body and make sure it's not something that's unnatural. And you really don't know. You really, really don't know. It's crazy. It's crazy. And the Petri dish meat, if they're just talking about it now, I'm pretty sure the public's probably been eating it if you eat that stuff. And Facts. It's just, you haven't been aware of it. Like, I don't put nothing past these people. Once you see it in the news, that means it's probably been around for at least 10 years minimum. Straight up. That's pretty much how it goes with this country and how it does things. And just remember, this country is notorious for experimenting on its populace. It's notorious for experimenting on its military personnel, both benounced and unbeknownst to them. And they don't care about their populace. This is a corporation, you know, and corporations don't care about people. They care about shareholders. And that's just a fact. And that's what we're dealing with right now, is that we're just commodities to them. That's really what it is. And it's been this way for a very, very long time. And it's just that the average citizen doesn't get access to this knowledge unless somebody who's older than them imparts it to them in some form or fashion, or they happen to just become a studious, researcher, and they start really digging into things and start uncovering certain truths to themselves that are historically documented, and then it just starts shifting your view of everything, and just especially when it comes to eating. So that's crazy. But like I said, I'm pretty sure the public's been eating Petri dish beef and had no idea they're eating it. I just know that for a fact. I remember when we went to Kemet, my family and I, with Renoko Rashidi in 2007, and we had a layover in Amsterdam. And I remember my son just happened to go to the McDonald's in Amsterdam, and he said that it was the best food he ever had. And I said, well, it's real food, because we don't really do McDonald's and stuff like that. But he wanted to try what they had there. And I said, okay, I mean, it's a one-shot thing. Go ahead. And he was just like, wow, it tastes completely different. And I said, that's because they're not using GMO products. So when you taste something, it's different. You know, I remember somebody on another radio program was discussing bananas. And the fact that when you go back to your childhood, when your parents brought home a bundle of bananas, the whole kitchen would smell like bananas. They had a pungent, pungent odor. And when you open them up, you could see the little black seeds in them as you split it down the middle or you cut it into quarters. Nowadays, you don't see as many seeds. And then if you notice, they don't smell as strong. And that's a fact. That is a fact. Even in Trinidad, we have these small bananas. In Trinidad, we call them figs. But they're just pretty much baby bananas. And they come in these big bundles. And when, you know, my grandmother or my cousin would bring a bundle home, the whole house would smell like bananas. It was just, the smell would envelop an area because they were just fresh. You could tell they just came off of a tree, just fresh stuff. And when you go to the store and buy bananas now, you got to stick your nose in it to smell it. So there's a lot of things that have been doctored and altered in a lot of ways, and we're just not aware of it as the public who's consuming this stuff for the most part. So yeah,
it's
that
crazy.
Petri dish meat, people been eating it.
It's getting worse, and they charging you more for it.
Exactly, because the dollar ain't worth a damn. So you go in and they want to charge you an arm and a leg for something that's not even real. It's insane. But it's America, you know. Who was that? What's his name? Childish Gambino. This is America. Yeah, this is America.
Hey, speaking of, that's a perfect segue. This comes from NPR.
Uh-huh.
Florida approves bill allowing classroom teachers to be armed. Now.
Yes.
Florida, California are normally the two most desirable places for these trial for whatever they're going to pass.
New York is another one, too.
Hmm.
Now, I said New York City specifically, and New York State is another one. Because
New York.
Remember, that's when they first started charging children as adults, was in New York City, and then it spread to the rest of the country. So, yeah, those three areas, you're absolutely right. They're like the incubators. They incubate stuff and they test it and see how it works. And then they'll roll it out. And it's a nationwide law after a while or some sort of precedent is set. But go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Nah, I'm finna give you, because I want to just get through these few little articles so we can get into the show. But,
sure.
Nah, I'm not going to get into it. Just, all of these articles we're speaking of, you can find this in BTR community. And just be aware of this. It's happening now. It will spread, essentially deputizing race soldiers that have our children for sometimes more than we do. Just keep that in your mind. You can go ahead with what you was going to say about it, but I'm going to find this next article.
All I wanted to say is there's an epidemic of child rape across the United States in schools. Every week you can find articles upon articles of white women raping little boys, black, white, don't matter. I've even seen a black woman who was raping, having sex with a 13-year-old student, and because she didn't give him $100, he exposed her, which is what he had threatened to do, and she just laughed it off, and when she didn't pay him, he went public, and she got arrested. There's teachers of all kinds that are just getting off on sexually assaulting students and young children. So you have that. And that's not even being discussed or dealt with, the fact that that is an epidemic. You can go through week by week and you will just put in teachers and child molestation or teacher abusing children, and it's just going to pull up a plethora of articles every single week. So no one's discussing that. But then on top of that, you're going to arm teachers and tell them if something goes down in the school, we feel that you are equipped. We're deputizing you to go out and bust guns in school. And then on top of that, you're not taking account for racist students who might already have some sort of vendetta against a particular non-white student, black or whoever, because they've been practicing on them their whole school career that they've had that student. And now you're giving them the legal ability to shoot them. And you mean to tell me they're not going to pull what the cop did? Yo, he made me fear for my life. I thought he was reaching for something, so I shot him. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. It is going to happen. Our children get body slammed, get choked, get their hair yanked out. They get tased. They get shot. Like, this is unprecedented that they would allow a teacher or teachers to be deputized to carry weapons in class. And again, these are teachers, some of them, who will have no problem and have taken sexual liberty with our children. So now you got a gun-toting rapist in the class, and our child is supposed to feel safe, knowing that this teacher has said some questionable things or may have touched them in a questionable way or made suggestive comments, and then you put a gun on their waist and say, hey, we deputize you too. So if the you know, these young fools act up and somebody want to come to school shooting up the school as the premise, you can go, you know, you can go straight racist on them and just gun them down like the dog in the street, and it's going to be okay. And if you don't like Billy in the corner because, like I said, you had some issue with him and he happened to be non-white, and he's a borderline student as far as just one of those children that are real close to on the edge of just quitting school altogether, and you get the opportunity to set up a scenario where you can kill him that you won't, come on now, this is insane. But this is America. And I mean, America is one big experiment. And the biggest part of the experiment is the sanity of the participants in the experiment. That's the biggest part of the experiment in America, is that you got a bunch of really mentally damaged, borderline and fully insane people, black people in particular, you know, 500 years of pure terrorism and just anything goes anarchy as far as our experience. And then on top of that, you give people license to rape our children, which they've been doing since we got here, since the slave ship, since the continent leading up to the slave ship.
I mean, they done turned the school into a straight up plantation. They have overseers with pistols.
Man, it's just crazy. Because I remember when I was in high school, that's when they started putting metal detectors in school in New York City. I remember that vividly, because it went from school, you know, the school not having them, and you just had a couple of police, you know, usually it was either police officers or off-duty or ex-police officers or whatever. There were always police-associated folks that were security guards in the school, and that was pretty much it, you know. But once they put the metal detectors, then people just found different ways to get their weapons in the school. You have your man go to the side door, you put your bag through, but you hand him the 25 or the 22, and he'll hold it for you because he already went through the metal detector, so he's holding your gun. You're going, you know, they check your bag, you look good, and you in school, and you got your 22 in your boots. That's the type of stuff that used to happen. Or machete. I mean, it was just all kinds of weapons that would come through that side entrance. And that, you know, go ahead, have your metal detectors. You're going to find a way around it. It used to happen all the time. Cats used to be in the welding class, you know, welding their guns. They got damaged somehow. They literally in welding class repairing their weapons. This is stuff I personally saw. So it's just crazy. It's crazy to me because, I think the teachers are the last people that should, matter of fact, go back and read about the schools, the first schools in Europe, the University of Salamanca, etc. Go back and read about the oldest universities on earth when you're talking about Waset and Warit, which is Karnak and Luxor, and these other temple complexes were actually schools. They didn't have none of that. You didn't go to school and have your child raped by the teacher. You didn't go to school and people are packing weapons to protect the students from other students or protect the students from some crazy teacher. Like, look at the psychology of that. And then you're dealing with racism. So you have a black child that's carrying all kind of inferiority complexes based on what the society is giving to them in every arena of life, but especially from the television. And they're walking in feeling inferior already because all they're learning about is you were a slave, you went through civil rights, you know, we freed you, and y'all are the scum of the earth and y'all are the dirt that we trample upon every day. And then you put a racist teacher with a gun on their hip there. Like, where in the history of education did that ever happen except for now? And especially with white supremacists in control of the entire society that we live in. Like, this don't sound crazy to you, that your child goes to school and the teacher might have a gun on their waist? Like, just the sound of that, it just sounds, it sounds like something out of, like, Blade Runner or something. It just sounds like something that's so far-fetched. It's just ridiculous. Like where how do we get to this new normal is what I'm asking. But that's how the system works. Things change so rapidly, you wake up one day and there's gun-toting teachers in your school. It's that fast because it's already happened in Florida. So you know what? Florida's going to set a precedent and you're going to see other states start to do the same thing. And the difference is the level of white supremacy practiced in those other states in certain areas are going to be different. So you're going to start seeing incidences of teachers shooting students. And then it's going to be teachers shooting students on camera and probably getting away with it. Just like the police did. And I predicted that when the Rodney King incident happened and people looked at me like I had eight heads. I said, they're going to kill us on camera and people are going to let them walk. Because of what happened with Rodney King. And people thought I was nuts when I was in my early 20s talking about that. I said, I guarantee you, that's our new normal. We live that every day. They're now coming out with Sandra Bland footage that's completely revolutionizing her case. It's never been released to the public, but she took her own film footage. So you get a better understanding of why she had an attitude and she was so angry, because she was being pretty much abused and set up. So, I mean, it's what it is, man. This is the new normal. And none of this stuff will make our people come up with new savvy ways to get our children out of their school. I don't know if anything else which should make you want to try and come up with some sort of collective idea, because not everybody has money, but you can come up with a collective idea for people to be able to facilitate something like that in order to have your children in a safe environment where nobody needs to tote a freaking gun in class and you're not worrying about the potential of somebody raping your student during the day.
Hey, man, the first thing that's going to have to happen is you're going to have to see if that's coming up on the books in your local election.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Because you have a chance to vote against that. So keep that in mind. What was that next article? I believe I'm going to leave those other ones alone because we have quite a few from your side. So how about you give out the contact information and we will do this first little break.
All right, cool. You are now live on Real Life, the radio show with myself, Brother Rod, and my partner and co-host, Genesep Rock. If you wish to call in to make a comment or ask a question, please do at 719-284-5271. Again, that's 719-284-5271. And the code is 70637. Please watch the background noise when you do call in. Again, if you wish to call in, it's 719-284-5287, and the code is 70637.
Did you want to start? Because there was some questions that was posed to you. Matter of fact, go on to kind of set it up, what we're getting ready to do.
Okay. There were just some things that I wanted to kind of go into and just discuss in regards to a few topics related to us as a collective. And things, some of it has to do with codification. Other things have to do with the how and why we do some of the things we do collectively. Another one would have to do with, again, codified functioning using the 48 laws of power. There's one that we'll be honing in on in regards to that and what that looks like. And then just some suggestions on how to kind of keep your focus on what's most important, because a lot of times if you're really trying to do things to make the world a better place and help other victims of racism navigate the system as successfully as you can in a situation like the one that we're in collectively, then it can be easy to become discouraged. It can be easy to feel like your work is ineffective because of a small minority of people who might behave in rogue manners and don't know how to disagree without being negatively disagreeable. So a lot of times we can get to those places where we're beaten up and we're downtrodden and we feel like, well, just screw everything, I want to throw in the towel, because some people just don't appreciate what I'm attempting to do. And it can be easy to do that. I've had those moments where I've questioned things too, just because it's it can be tough sometimes. And you have a lot of different forces against you when you are out there doing things that are constructive. Neely Fuller says it all the time. White people don't pay any attention to Black people in any significant way as far as tampering with your life until you start doing something constructive. The moment you start doing something that is helpful and constructive for other Black people and yourself, that is when white people want to pay you attention. So it's not just being out publicly speaking against white supremacy or helping people come into knowledge that they may not have had. It's really the effectiveness of what you're doing. Once you start to have a positive effect, that's when things start to converge on you. Like, you look at what happened with Minister Farrakhan. It was just blanket. All social media, practically, he's been booted off of. But he's been doing what he's been doing for years. They've just decided at this particular point, because we're really in a fascist society. People have been talking about that for a number of years now. Now that Donald Trump's in office, the word fascism comes up more regularly than it ever has as far as in the politics of this country. And that's what they do. They shut down what they call dissident voices voices of dissent. And I know that Minister Farrakhan has done and said, has said some things that they would deem as hate speech and things like that. But there's a ton of people on Facebook and Instagram and all of that stuff that are white supremacists, and nothing is being done about them. It's the same thing with we talked about the disappearance of Black literature in our books, and the fact that before they killed the Jews, they first burned all the books, got rid of all of the literature. So people did not have access to anything that would provide some level of insight into what's happening and possibly ways you can learn from history so you don't repeat those things collectively. All of that was gone. Then the next thing they did was they took their guns. And then after that, they went to concentration camps. So you have voices that are speaking about things that the system does not like them speaking about. They're now kicked off, as well as some of the right-wing groups as well. So they're trying to make it look like it's balanced and equitable. I don't use the term fair. So that's the way that they're doing things. But ultimately, it's about shutting down the voices of Black people. When you go into Amazon and stuff, they talk about getting rid of material that they deem to be offensive and that they deem to be carrying fake information. Nation of Islam text, the specific one that I read about in the article, was the secret relationship between Blacks and Jews. Now, if anybody owns those texts, which I own all three volumes, when you look at them, it's the historically accurate information taken directly from Jewish people who were either involved in the slave trade or historians discussing the slave trade, who tell about themselves the fact that the main traders of slaves and the people who were what you would call the merchant class in the slave trade were Jews. That's a fact. One of the main reasons that you have some people in Jamaica that carry Jewish names is because you had a lot of Jewish slave owners in Jamaica. That was one of the ways that people were making a connection to the whole Hebrew thing, was through their slave masters on the island. Not all of them were doing it that way, but there were a lot of people who were caught up in that because they carried the slave masters' names, which happened to be Jewish names. So they immediately attached themselves to the struggles of the people in the Bible.
You about to do it.
So, I'm just mentioning that because that's just a fact. But ultimately, so I think where you want to start at, first I want to say one thing. There is a place in Brooklyn, and it's one of the only places in New York that deals with the history of Black people specifically in Brooklyn. And it's called Weeksville. It's called the Weeksville Heritage Center. And it is pretty much the remnants of an all-black town that people were running to get away from white supremacy, where blacks owned their own stuff. They did their own thing. They had their own stuff. It was like a black Wall Street right in the middle of Brooklyn. And they have a couple of houses from that era. And it's a whole museum complex that they're about to close. So I put the GoFundMe in there, because if people can help, it'll preserve our heritage in that particular place. It's a beautiful place. I've been there multiple times. My wife actually did an event there a few months ago, and they're literally on the verge of closing. So that's what I wanted to put out there. Because if you look at Senegal Village, which is erroneously called Seneca Village, that used to be Central Park, there's very little information there, except I think there's a plaque in the park, and you'll have to dig it up. But it's an area that Booker T. Coleman, a.k.a. Baba Kaba Kamina, the Hiawatha Kabbana, talked about, and the fact that it was actually called Senegal Village because the majority of people who lived there were from Senegal. They were former enslaved Africans that formed their own community, and that was where it was. And they basically used eminent domain to kick them off the land and create what's now Central Park. So this information is important to preserve so that people can get the accurate history told by our own people who know their own history and who've done the research to present that information, rather than anything that's misinformation coming from other folks who purposefully may be misleading you or just don't know what they're talking about. So yeah, Weeksville. I would just say, if you can donate to them and just help them to be able to maintain their space and preserve that history, that heritage of black people, specifically in Brooklyn. It's the Brooklyn's version of Black Wall Street. They're all over the place. That's one of them. And we might lose that information. So just wanted to put that out there. So let's go with, because I said they were kind of in order. Remember?
Yeah. So just to follow you up, you can find all of these articles on NBTR community. Go join that, $24 a year. Hey, yeah. Especially Roz be laying out a lot of stuff. But here we go.
Historian Julia Scott has a new book out called The Common Wind. It shows how enslaved people in the Caribbean secretly communicated with each other to resist and sometimes even escape their captors. It's an untold aspect of slavery, and it's made The Common Wind academia's trendiest read. But the book isn't actually new. Scott wrote it as his PhD dissertation in 1986.
The first place that I submitted it to returned it and said, it's a pretty nice dissertation, but we're not really interested in publishing it. We think it's too narrow and specialized. My view at the time was that I was going to return to it. I just never did. I just wasn't sure that it was quite good enough to be a book yet. People say this to me all the time. You're a perfectionist. When people use that term, it sounds like a compliment, but it's really kind of a critique. The idea of my being a perfectionist meant that I would never let go of this dissertation. Even now, I don't really necessarily believe that what is going to come out as The Common Wind is like perfect.
While the manuscript sat unpublished, its legend grew, like a particularly hot academic mixtape. Photocopies and PDFs were passed around to readers, including historian Marcus Rediker.
The Common Wind had an extraordinary underground life, even though, or I should say, especially because it was unpublished. It was not altogether easy to get a hold of, but that became part of its mystique and part of its power.
At the heart of Scott's book is the Haitian Revolution of the 1790s, when enslaved Africans successfully revolted against the French, ultimately making Haiti the first country to be founded by formerly enslaved people. What Scott found was that even though enslaved people in the Caribbean were oppressed and seemingly isolated, they often knew more about what was happening than their enslavers did.
The ways in which word, news, information, rumors, half-truths traveled from place to place, and the role that people of African descent played in that process is really what it's about. There were a lot of little specks where people tried to establish for themselves a little bit more mobility and sometimes were able to grasp some freedom.
So how did Scott finally make it into bookstores? In 2015, a Verso editor asked Redeker what he'd recommend publishing, and he said The Common Wind.
It was, to my mind, perfectly appropriate that the reputation of The Common Wind was built by word of mouth, by conversation, by people spreading the news, which was a perfect parallel to the story Julia Scott was telling about how the word of the Haitian Revolution was actually spread. By word of mouth, by whispering on the lower decks of a ship, people talking about something that they considered to be urgently important. The reaction of historians in a great many fields, now that they know the book has been published, their reaction has been joy. Joy, I mean, people are delighted.
Wow, that was... Had never heard of The Common Wind.
Yes, sir. And it's a text that really puts something, shines a spotlight or elucidates something very important. What they're talking about is social media. That was Black people's social media, word of mouth. Just like when I was growing up, the streets was the internet. We knew everything before the white people knew that was going on in the street. When stuff would happen, if you were connected to the right people, you knew what happened, because you were connected to the right people, or you may have actually been there yourself. And it would spread through word of mouth. And we had our own lingo that white people couldn't decipher for many years until we started inviting them to our culture and inviting them into the things we do. And we gave away our ability to use the English language in ways that were clandestine. So what they're talking about is social media, but between human beings without electronic devices. That's what, when we went into the drum culture, the fact that we had drums and we could actually communicate between islands as well, just by drumming. And you had to be initiated into that, the drum school. And they would teach you how to do just that. So the drum was like the telephone, and you could coordinate revolution by the drum. That's why the drum, one of the main reasons the drum was outlawed. It was because of the spiritual practice, the ability to call down African gods and ancestors. That was extremely dangerous to white people, because these were the things that the Haitians used to free themselves, the ability to become possessed. Imagine you have 1,000 people and they're all possessed by Ogun, who is the deity of war. And he is known to kill everything in sight when he's unleashed. And you got 1,000 soldiers, Haitian soldiers, who are in that possessed state, and they're able to take multiple shots and continue at their attackers in ways that white people had never seen before. This is stuff that's happened before. And this was also discussed in the war, the Battle of Isandlwana in South Africa, the same sort of thing, where these African warriors seemed unkillable. They would shoot them 3, 4, 5 times, and the person would still keep coming at them. And they'll be slaughtering white people all along the way. So this book is talking about communication. And I think that we need to start learning way, or going back to using ways of communication that does not involve using technology.
Creating a new culture.
Exactly. So we might partake of social media and do that stuff, but when it comes to certain things that are of importance, we do not communicate it on social media. We have different ways of communicating with each other and reaching each other long distance, and start utilizing those ways, because the majority of people don't. And it'll be easier for us to have communication that's not interrupted or intercepted or commandeered by the enemy, so they can find out what we're talking about. But that's what they're talking about, our ancestors' ability to communicate and foster revolution by having extremely important conversations and being social media and spreading ideas through word of mouth.
Okay, now hold on, because I believe we are skipping ahead. We're going to get to the oracle type conversation here in a little bit. We're going to get to this Dr. Amos Wilson video real quick.
Sure.
So each of us is going to make his or her own individual contract with the system. Each of us is is going to make his or her own individual contract with the system that dominates us. Each one of us then thinks that we can engage in individual salvation. This is destructive and will lead to the destruction of African American people and African people. We will die with tremendous amounts of knowledge and skills in our heads. If those skills and if the knowledge is not coordinated and combined in the sense of nation and in the sense of peoplehood, the amount of individual accumulation and knowledge and skills will save us as a people. It is only when that accumulated knowledge and the accumulated skills that we have are coordinated under the banner of nationhood and peoplehood will we then save ourselves as a people, and we will be saved individually as persons.
Man.
You see why I wanted him to, wanted to play that?
Oh, yes. I already knew.
Yeah. It's pretty much everybody coming as individual groups, petitioning white people for whatever it may be that you're petitioning them for. And we've been doing that for hundreds of years and to no avail. One of the big proponents of, and actually he worked towards doing this is what got him killed, was Malcolm X, of a Pan-African approach to solving our global problem. He got leaders from Asia and the Far East. He got leaders from the Middle East. He got leaders from the African continent. He got leaders from South America. He got leaders from Central America and the Caribbean. And he had himself, and he also was able to get Dr. King to understand that this was a global struggle for human rights, not a local struggle for civil rights. And that is why they offed him. If you read the book, The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X, it explains that. They
repeat
were so
that book one more time.
He was able to get a collective. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Repeat the book one more time.
Sure. It's called The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X. And the author, his name is Carl, and that's K-A-R-L. Last name is Evans, E-V-A-N-Z-Z. That is his name. And the book is extremely important if you're trying to really understand what happened to Malcolm, why he was killed. And it goes into declassified FBI and CIA documents in that text. They also discussed the over 360 murder attempts on Fidel Castro. They discussed the death of Che. They discussed the attempts on the life of Bob Marley. They discussed Patrice Lumumba. They just, but the book is focused most intensely and importantly on Malcolm X, but they do talk about these other personages, historical personages in the text, and give greater insight into some of the things that happened to them and things of that nature. So yeah, that is an extremely important text. But what it was is he was able to get all of these different people to put aside the religious differences, put aside any other differences they had, and understand that they had a common enemy and they needed to come together collectively as oppressed people that were non-white against these people, these countries that went around terrorizing and slaughtering and genociding other non-white people. That is why Malcolm was killed. So for everybody who's had negative things to say about Pan-Africanism, what have you done? And when has Pan-Africanism ever gotten a real chance to come to fruition and do what it was intended to do? It hasn't. Everybody who's attempted, whether it's Kwame Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, Minister Malcolm, Dr. Martin Luther King, all the people who've come to that realization have either been defamed and put in jail, Marcus Garvey, or off. So now you have, again, for the first time in a very long time, a lot of young people, young African-descended people globally who are coming to the same understanding on an individual level, but collectively on the same page that we got the same problem here. And it hasn't changed because we have to do something different. And that's the only thing that hasn't been tried is, hey, a critical mass of us coming together to facilitate the change that all of us need. It just hasn't been done before. But if you study our enemy, that is exactly how they took over the world. They used to slaughter each other wholesale. All the stuff that they've done to us, they perfected on their own first. And then they said, you know what? We need to stop killing each other. We're a minority. Let's go around the world and kill all the other non-white people and subjugate them and make them do the things that we were never able to accomplish because we were living, you know, a subhuman existence, you know, foraging in the hills of Rome, of Europe, acting like savages. So they did all the work for us. Let's just commandeer their work and make them, you know, do the work for us. And they were able to stop killing each other long enough to dominate us. So they've created a global system that started in America. Remember, the creation of white people as we know them today was in America. It wasn't Germany, wasn't Britain, it was America. And America infected the rest of the planet with this global ideology of white supremacy and white people and them having a special place in the world above everyone else. And it goes into and it infects every one of the 11 areas of people activity. And I will name them: economics, education, entertainment, healthcare, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, war, and now technology. Even the AI is racist.
Oh, hold on.
Go ahead.
Real quick. AI. I think I had this in here too.
Okay.
I can't find the article just yet, but it's talking about they done created a AI computer that could write AI software. So,
I think I saw it, but I didn't get to read it. That's when I wanted to go back to, and I didn't get the chance to.
Yeah.
Did you get to, can you elaborate on it a little bit, even though you can't find it?
I didn't get a chance to get into it myself. I'm looking for
it. Okay, so we might have to pick that one back up. Let me see if I can find it. I think it's one of these.
Well, no worries. We just go continue on.
Okay, no problem. The next one would be, let's go with the Dr. Clark one.
All right, just give me a...
And he's young. This is a young Dr. Clark. I knew him when he was older, or met and dealt with him when he was way older. But he's no less brilliant.
Okay, sorry for the dead space.
All right.
Okay. Now, where are we without the clock, correct?
Yes.
What happened to the so-called Negro culture in America?
The most tragic destruction of African culture was the destruction of the African culture brought to these shores, brought to America's shores. Now, the first thing they did was to forbid the drum, forbid all African ceremonies, forbid African ornaments, literally to destroy a people in such a manner that they had to be remade in an American image. This was not exactly true in the West Indies. It was slavery, make no mistake about it. But because it was on an island, many of the Africans could communicate with each other and maintain some of the African culture, while in the United States it was impossible, because as they arrived, mother, brother, sister were split up and they went in opposite directions. Then they were resold. They might have been resold within a matter of days after they were sold the last time. So it was difficult for relatives to keep track of each other, and it was difficult for a continuity to be maintained in African culture. This was the beginning of the fragmenting of our family in this country. It was also the beginning of the demeaning and the negation of the masculinity of the black male in America. This demeaning of our culture and this reading us out of the commentary of human history has left deep psychological scars. What we are trying to do now is a massive job of rebuilding the inside, the spirits, the hopes, the history, the culture of a people. We're trying to restore those values that have been taken away, and we're trying to get across to black youth that they have a part to play in the making of a new world. They have the imagination, they have the energy. You must first restore that part of yourself that has been negated by oppression. It is as essential to you as bread and water. It is part of the food that must feed your spirit in the world of tomorrow, and it is part of what you will have to transfer to your children.
Jenna, before we discuss it, I want you to play the Todd Bridges clip, and then we're going to discuss it.
You want me to play what?
The Todd Bridges clip.
Okay. Let me see.
Yeah, and then we'll discuss it.
You talking about the throwback?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, last week I had you write an essay about the things that you liked the most. This week I thought it might be fun if we wrote an essay about the things that we disliked the most. Solomon?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you think of something that you dislike?
Being a nigger. I didn't mean nothing bad. The teacher asked the question and I just answered it.
Why'd you say it?
Because it's the truth. If and I was white, my pa still be alive. Being a nigga killed my pa. You answer me something, sir.
If I can.
Would you like to live to be 100?
I'm sure I would. It's not very likely, but I guess all of us like to live to a ripe old age.
Would you rather be black and live to be 100, or white and live to be 50?
That is a famous clip of Todd Bridges on Little House on the Prairie. And that was the discussion you just heard. Now, if you listen to what Dr. Clark talked about, the lack of continuity of African culture and the way that it was imposed on American Africans versus Africans in other parts of the world, that is the uniqueness of the American African experience. The apartheid terrorism that was so thorough, it was like there was no place for you to go to escape it. And you know, like he was saying, it was a little less intense on the islands, but they did do the same sort of things. They did outlaw the drum, which created a series of instrument developments in Trinidad and Tobago specifically, until the development of the steel pans, the tambu bamboo, and a bunch of other instruments that were created prior to the creation of the steel pan, which eventually became the steel pan. So they did do those sorts of things, but it was just not done in the capacity and on a intense level like it was done here. It was just so thorough and so all pervasive and violent and terroristic that it was bad. And it's funny because both areas had things about them that you could say, wow, the people in the islands had it worse than the people in the mainland and vice versa. It'll be just a comparison of terroristic stories between two different groups of people, because they might have been different types of terrorism applied, but the effect was no different, except that America just had a unique brand because it was the creation engine of white supremacy. All that we've come to know about white supremacy as it is expressed today is an American creation, and it started with the creation of white people in 1681. That is the origin of what we are living right now. And it didn't come to America from any place else but America. The people who are behind it were the rich planters who originally came from England. But it was an American creation. And it is now infected everywhere. So I think that the importance of that is when we look at reparations. I was watching a great video that Dr. Mumbi had. She had a question and answer with this brother from England. And he was talking about the fact that reparations is not just about money. And right. It's so true. It's about reclaiming the aspects of your humanity that have been lost, getting mental health services to deal with the intergenerational trauma, learning how to cope with the experiences that you've had as a Black person, and then also facilitating an end legally to those experiences, creating a special class status where, like, Jews have a special class status because of their so-called Holocaust. They have a special class status in the United States. American Africans should have a special class status, period. And that is because of the type of terrorism that was imposed upon them. And again, the subsequent terrorism that's still being imposed upon them and immigrant Blacks. Because it's happening to everybody. You got more than enough immigrant Blacks gunned down by police unarmed that can coincide directly with the number of American Africans gunned down unarmed by police here. So when it comes to the modern terrorism, it's something that all Black people experience. But when it comes to the historical on this soil, it is American Africans' unique experience. So what did you have to say about those two particular clips, Jenna?
Hey, man, you kind of covered all the bases, but I would like to just add the $20 million lawsuit that the Australian suspected racist got from the immigrant, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That just shows the double standard. Mm-hmm. Exactly what you was talking about, but I'm just anxious to hear about this last one. So you ready to get to the next article?
Yes. The next one would be Law 36.
Law 36. Disdain things you cannot have. Ignoring them is the best revenge. By acknowledging a petty problem, you give it existence and credibility. The more attention you pay an enemy, the stronger you make him, and a small mistake is often made worse and more visible when you try and fix it. It is sometimes best to leave things alone. If there is something you want but cannot have, show contempt for it. The less interest you reveal, the more superior you seem. To disdain something is to show that very thing that it is unworthy of your consideration or respect. So it's the idea of choosing not to let things bother you by showing them disdain when life throws you things that may really affect the average person. You choose to show disdain instead, to stay stoic, to stay stable, because you can just as easily choose not to notice the irritating offender, to consider the matter trivial and unworthy of your interest. That is the powerful move. What you do not react to cannot drag you down in a futile engagement. The best lesson you can teach an irritating gnat is to co-sign it to the oblivion by ignoring it. But if it is impossible to ignore, then conspire in secret to do away with it, but never inadvertently draw attention to the bothersome insect that will go away or die on its own. And this insect is the metaphor for our life's problems, the people who may affect us in a negative way. That's what it represents. I'm going to quote Ballister Grayson, an incredible writer and philosopher who's littered all throughout this book. You should take very few grievances to heart, for to do so is to give yourself groundless worry. It is a topsy-turvy way of behaving to take to heart cares which you ought to throw over your shoulder. Many things which seemed important at the time turn out to be of no account when they are ignored, and others, which seem trifling, appear formidable when you pay attention to them. Things can easily be settled at the outset, but not so later on. In many cases, the remedy itself is the cause of the disease. To let things be is not the least satisfactory of life's rules. Ballister Grayson. So in other words, by ignoring people, you cancel them out. And this can unsettle and infuriate them. But since they have no dealings with you anymore, there is nothing they can do. And this is the offensive aspect of this law. Playing the card of contempt is immensely powerful, for it lets you determine the conditions of the conflict because the war is waged on your terms. You are the king, and you ignore what offends you. And this tactic will often infuriate people. Half of what they do is to get your attention, and when you hold it from them, they flounder in frustration. Keys to power. Desire often creates paradoxical effects. The more you want something, the more you chase after it. The more it eludes you. The more interest you show, the more you repel the object of your desire. This is because your interest is too strong. It makes people awkward, even fearful. Uncontrollable desire makes you seem weak and unworthy. Now, psychologically, this makes sense. I've experienced this firsthand myself, and I know many others have as well, especially through the communities of relationship pickup artistry communities, where these individuals would teach other men and women develop this confidence within themselves, but also how to not make the mistakes of being too forward, of being too aggressive in their approach towards women. It's no secret that coming on too strong or coming on too aggressive and desiring too much can have the effect we just talked about, can often repel the opposite sex, can repel this person away from you, and suddenly, once they thought you were attractive, now they think the opposite because of your approach, your demeanor, your tenor that made them repel you. Unfortunately, in what I've seen, some experiences I've had, that sometimes people take this too far and now they begin to play games and have then gone too far in the opposite direction. So find the middle ground. You need to turn your back on what you want. Show your contempt and disdain. This is the kind of powerful response that will drive your targets crazy. They will respond with a desire of their own, which is simply to have an effect on you, perhaps to possess you, perhaps to hurt you. And if they want to possess you, you have successfully completed the first step of seduction. If they want to hurt you, you have unsettled them and made them play by your rules. Laws 8 and 39 on baiting people into action talk about this in depth. Contempt is the prerogative of the king. Where his eyes turn, what he decides to see is what has reality. What he ignores and turns his back on is as good as dead. That was a weapon of King Louis XIV. If he did not like you, he acted as if you were not there, maintaining his superiority by cutting off the dynamic of interaction. This is the power you have when you play the card of contempt, periodically showing people that you can do without them. It's also this idea of not letting people take you for granted. By showing contempt and disdain, by backing off, by turning away for a period of time, people may realize your true value and worth. Or on the flip side, they may realize that you actually had no value and worth. So it can really reveal who you are and what position you have within a certain relationship or within a certain circumstance. But so often people lose their emotion, they lose their cool, by paying attention to such little events that really have no major significance in the long-term effects of their lives. They pay attention to the puny enemy. By paying attention to this small enemy, you look puny, you look small, and the longer it takes you to crush such an enemy. Another danger, if you succeed in crushing this irritant, or even if you merely wound it, you create sympathy for the weaker side. Critics of Franklin D. Roosevelt complained bitterly about the money his administration spent on government projects, but their attacks had no resonance with the public who saw the president as working to end the Great Depression. In 1971, the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, which is a group of documents about the history of the US involvement in Indochina. Henry Kissinger erupted in a volcanic rage, furious about the Nixon administration's vulnerability to this kind of damaging leak. He made recommendations that led to a formation of this group called the Plumbers to plug the leaks. And this eventually led to a chain of events that actually led to Nixon's downfall. So in hindsight, and reflective in the reality, the publications of the Pentagon Papers was not a serious threat to the administration, but Kissinger's reaction, his eruption of emotion, made it a big deal. So in him trying to fix this one problem, he created another. A paranoia for security that in the end was much more destructive to the government. Had he ignored the Pentagon Papers, the scandal they had created would eventually have passed and blown over. What does this mean for you and me? Great question. Oftentimes, we want to try and fix our mistakes. It's very tempting to often want to fix every little ailment, a mistake we make within our relationships, within our lives. Oftentimes, the harder we try to fix these things, the worse we can make them. It is sometimes more politic to leave these things alone and let time pass and see if time can be the ailment for these problems that we once thought we needed to take care of. In other words, patience. Instead of inadvertently focusing attention on a problem, making it seem worse by publicizing how much concern and anxiety it is causing you, it is often far wiser to play the contemptuous aristocrat, not deigning to acknowledge the problem's existence. There are several ways to execute this strategy. First, the sour grapes approach. If there is something you want but you realize you cannot have, the worst thing you can do is draw attention to your disappointment by complaining about it. An infinitely more powerful tactic is to act as it never really interested you in the first place. Second, when you are attacked by an inferior, deflect people's attention by making it clear that the attack has not even registered. Look away or answer sweetly, showing how little the attack concerns you. Similarly, when you yourself have committed a blunder, the best response is often to make less of your mistake by treating it lightly. Among equals, this tactic might backfire. Your indifference could make you seem callous. But with a master, if you act quickly and without great fuss, it can work to great effect. You bypass his angry response, save him the time and energy he will waste by brooding over it, and allow him the opportunity to display his own lack of pettiness publicly. If we make excuses and denials when we are caught in a mistake or deception, we stir the waters and make the situation worse. It is often wiser to play things the opposite way. The Renaissance writer Pietro Aretino often boasted of his aristocratic lineage, which was of course fiction, it was a lie, since he was actually the son of a simple shoemaker. And when his enemy finally revealed this embarrassing truth, word quickly spread, and soon all of Venice was known to Aretino's lie. So imagine someone caught you out in one of the biggest lies of your life. What would you do? Had Aretino tried to defend himself, this would have only dragged him down. His response was masterful. He announced that he was indeed the son of a shoemaker. But this only proved his greatness, since he had risen from the lowest stratum of society to its very pinnacle. From then on, he never mentioned his previous lie, trumpeting instead his new position on the matter of his ancestry. So he used what was once his biggest weakness, flaw, into his biggest strength to create his legacy. He didn't dwell on the fact that they caught him out in the lie. He doubled down on it and went all in. Remember, the powerful responses to niggling, petty annoyances and irritations are contempt and disdain. Never show that something has affected you or that you are offended. That only shows you've acknowledged a problem. Contempt is a dish that is best served cold and without affection. Reversal. You must play this card of contempt with care and delicacy. Most small troubles will vanish on their own if you leave them be, but some will grow and fester unless you attend to them. Ignore a person of inferior stature, and the next time you look, he has become a serious rival, and your contempt has made him vengeful as well. That is the danger of this law, underestimating people. Learn to distinguish between the potentially disastrous and the mildly irritating, and the nuance that will quickly go away on its own. In either case, though, never completely take your eye off it. As long as it is alive, it can smolder and spark into your life. Law 36. Disdain things you cannot have. Ignoring them is the best revenge.
The radio show with myself, Rod, and my co-host, Thundercat Black. If you do wish to call in and ask a question or make a comment, please give us a call at 719-284-5271. The code is 70637. Again, that number is 719-284-5271, and the code is 70637. Watch the background noise, please. Thanks once again.
speak to the 48 laws of power, the most important thing I received from that book is to be aware that a lot more people were aware of that book before you were, and to always expect them to be practicing these laws on you. And that's my most important advice, if I were giving it. To always expect someone to be practicing these laws and know which side of these laws you are located on.
I would say this. There's a lot of people that read those texts and they have no idea of how to put them into practice. I know a lot of people who read that text, but when it comes to applying what's in that text or applying some of the things you'll learn in The Art of War, The Book of the Five Rings, or any of those texts, Mastering the Art of War is a great book to read because it gives you practical experiences where the laws can apply. But there's a lot of people that read it and it's just like reading any other book. They read it and say, oh yeah, it's a really good book. You know, it has these, you know, this information, da da da. But they have no idea of how to apply it in real life scenarios. And this particular law is one of my favorites because it is something that is very accurate. You have to know when to apply it and how. And there's different scenarios where it can actually create enemies and put you in a more uncomfortable situation if you do it in the wrong situation with the wrong person. And in that regard, it would be someone who has some understanding of that law and they know how to turn it against you. So it's a game of chess, and it's really knowing how and when to apply it, what circumstance, scenario, and who the other party is that you're applying it on. And it does work. When you show contempt for things you can't have, a person can't use it against you. That's one of the things that the government used to do to recruit people, other black people, to do traitorous things against black people who they deem threats, enemies of the state, or whatever the case may be. They'll offer you something that either you couldn't have because as you were coming up, let's say you had a shortcoming that prevented you from partaking of things that other people did. So they'll give you access to that, or it'll be something that you just weren't able to obtain, but you really, really want, and they'll offer it to you. A lot of people, it's money. It's a certain sum of money. That's why they say everybody has a price. For other people, it might be women. If you were a guy who was kind of nerdy and you really couldn't get the so-called fly girls, but they're able to send you what you would consider the most beautiful woman you've ever seen, then for some men, it's that. For other men, it may be drugs. For other men, it might be a certain amount of money. But what it is that when you show disdain for it, then they can't use it against you. And you can even, some parents have even done it with their children. If you have a child, you're out, a young child, and you're out and they're misbehaving in a certain way, and you're not going to spank the child, but you're trying to get them to comply or to, let's say the child's running away from you, and you do everything, you keep calling them, they keep running. So then what you might do is, when the child is trying to get your attention, you ignore them. And that's showing them a form of disdain that makes them have to get your attention. So they run to seek your attention. So instead of you chasing the child, now the child is actually chasing you. So as a parent, you're using psychology in order to get them in line so that they stay within a certain radius so that you don't have to worry about them. But in the child's mind, it's the action of not paying them the attention in that moment that sets off in their mind, I need to go get mommy or daddy's or both of their attention. And that is a form of showing a disdain in a way, but it's not true disdain. It's a psychological tactic to get that particular child into a specific mindset so that you don't have to have a back and forth with them in public during that day. Go ahead.
I agree with you. And we have a caller. Caller, we'll get to you in just a second.
Because I was going to say, what you'll find is a child. Sometimes the child will show disdain for what they can't have. So they might want that lollipop. You tell them they can't have it. They are angry because they can't have it. So they show disdain for the fact that they can't have it, and they act out. And then some parents will cave in and just give him what he wants. He ends up playing it on you as the parent, and you sitting there like, well, dang, I didn't want him to have a lollipop, but he done agitated me so much, you know, that now I'm caving in now to give him what he wants. Now he's going to be bouncing off the wall into the nighttime because he had this sugar rush because I gave him the lollipop that I knew he shouldn't have had in the first place. So it's those little things. It's just like, and that's just a simple way of doing it, but it works with adults as well. It really does. One thing I could say, I remember, and this is just personal to me, my father, my mother's father, my grandfather, he was a very powerful and short man. He was a short in stature, but very powerful in our community in Trinidad. And he really didn't like my mother being with my father. And he made it a practice because he had beef with my father's dad. Like, him and my father were real close and cool at one point. They fell out. They became enemies. And it was, like, really, really bad. So neither wanted my parents to get married, but they loved each other beyond that and did it anyway. And it created a whole nother set of problems, but that's a whole nother story. The issue was that I learned from my grandfather, because I would hear these stories about him from my mother and other people who knew him well. He would never, ever, ever, ever mention my father or his father by name. He never once ever said their names out of his mouth. And that was his way of taking away any power they had, was by never voicing their name, never speaking their name. He would speak in ways where you knew who he was speaking about due to the implication of how he was speaking. So who he was implying, you could get that. But you would never get him to actually verbally say my grandfather's name or my father's name.
All right, now we're going to...
And that is a powerful thing. So go ahead.
Before we go to the caller, this is what I'm saying. Under the context of adults, a lot of adults have these practices, but they was just passed down to them as tradition. They don't know where they come from. They, they have no clue that that's a practice that's been going on for centuries. That's just something that somebody did to them that they do to their children, and it was just passed down. What I'm saying is it's a lot of these same instances, especially with suspected racists, that also have these practices, whether they know about the laws or they're just habits and practices that they have. What I'm saying is you should always have the... you should always go into the position that somebody's finna get rid of the practice on you. Just be aware of that and notice which laws they are trying to implement on you. But that's all I was saying. Carla, what's your name? Where are you calling from? And what's your question or comment? How are you tonight?
Greetings. Peace, brothers. This is Sister Sharon. Hi, how are you? I'm okay. A little worn out, but I'm all right. I've been listening, enjoying as usual. It's funny you said the art of war, because it took me right to Africa and the dragon being there, because Sun Tzu. And I was like, I have to call him now because he took the words out of my mouth. But Brother Jenna is correct. You know, a lot of things with our people and a lot of people is learned behavior. And I think when we find some of the negative aspects of this learned behavior, then we have to change it, you know, especially regarding child, child rearing. And a lot of the topics and this last piece, the author Wilson, wow, that was just so deep. I was like, okay, yeah, I have to call. That is practices, you know, they do practice that on us. They have for years, you know, but it's pieces within that that we can learn to use. You know, I agree with that. But, you know, it also can touch on that area that they're expert at,
doing well. Well, I don't know why you're so upset. You're doing well. Or, you know, it's very psychological, you know, and, you know, they're good at it. And, you know, they are able to communicate in a way that some of us don't even realize what they're actually saying. They can communicate with each other. I kind of know what they're actually saying, but it's like their little, like, secret code. But,
yeah,
I've always said
that black people and white people both speak English, but they're speaking two different
terms. Well, absolutely.
One way, and the black people take it at face value. This is what it says. And this is like a form of coded language. Yeah, go ahead.
It is. And that's why my dad always said, don't you let them get away with anything because you know what they're saying. But a lot of us don't, you know. And
you know, my main example of that is when you go to court, a black person will see on the building criminal justice system. So they think, I'm going to get me some justice. You know, I was done wrong. I'm about to go, you know, handle my business. This is the American way. The system's going to work for me. This is how a lot of us go in there thinking.
Yeah,
and then
I'm sure.
The white person sees it like this. Criminals run the justice system. Now I got to figure out which criminal whose palm I need to grease so I can get out of this situation. And then when you walk in the building, you see a symbol of my eye, the white woman. She's blindfolded. And she's holding a scale, and one of the scales is up and the other one's down. So they're telling you right there, symbolically, you're not getting justice. There's nothing equal about
that
system.
Right.
They're telling you
just with
the symbology alone. And then the white black guy walks in thinking, criminal justice system. I'm about to get you some justice. The white guy goes in thinking, criminals run the justice system. Now who's the most powerful criminal I need to go up to?
That's right.
Two different mentalities. Same language, all English.
Absolutely. You are correct. You know, earlier when you were talking, you touched a little bit on, you know, the banishment. And, you know, I think that's for all of us. That's a wake up. Mm-hmm. That's a wake up call. You know, some will hear it and some won't. But finding another source of communication, because weeks ago I sent you an email. It was just, you know, a very light email telling you the revolution will not be televised. Now, I know you know that, but, you know, Gil Scott Heron was one of the people I listened to avidly when I was younger. So something you said brought that to mind. One of the podcasts the night before, and I shot you the email the next morning because I said, oh, my gosh. Yeah, he's right. But let me tell him this from the old school. Yeah, the revolution won't be televised. So absolutely. Right. How will we really communicate with each other? But I still stand on, you know, everyone won't be saved. You know, everyone won't hear. Everyone won't become conscious, unfortunately. You know, the food thing you were talking about. Now, a lot of my time since I'm retired now, a lot of what I do is because my children work full time, I spend my time, I don't do social media, I never did, but I spend my time trying to track and keep up with these changes that are happening so quickly in our world as a protection for my loved ones.
Hold on, Ms. Sharon, real quick. Quick question.
Yes?
Can you give a few examples of the changes you've been tracking?
Oh, well, today I did the Google thing. You know, they're enhancing their OS. I mean, they're taking it really to another level, AI. However, I've been following the AI thing because Mr. Gates, he really had an agenda, and I didn't even know. Well, of course, I'm not a colleague of his, but when Bill Gates came to the scene, I had no idea that his genius went as far as AI and above. And we're talking body parts, like stuff, you know, really deep. So today I did the Google thing. I do volunteer 2 days a week at the hospital, but I have to monitor what's happening, the monetary thing. You know, the world thing, what they're doing to people, human beings, because we are human beings. So I do this. you know, a lot, oftentimes my children do catch things, but I want to be on the same page. We need to be on the same page as a family. And so then today, it's really, it's funny that you said this. So, you know, I do believe the ancestors watch over us. I called my carpenter today to have him build me a vegetable shed. Now, if you've ever seen a chicken shed, well, I'm going to have a chicken shed, but it's going to grow, house my vegetables that I'm going to grow. And the vegetable beds will be raised beds at the bottom, but you will open a door and go into it just like a chicken coop with the mesh wiring and all of that. Well, both of my grandparents had farms, so I know how to do these things. When my children were younger, my husband and I did a garden because they needed to see what nature can do, visibly see this out of your own household. And I haven't done a garden since then, but having grandchildren now, this will be our project this summer. They need to see this. Now, my flower beds are beautiful. Last weekend, my grandchildren and I wanted to put some more flowers down. My children don't do this, okay? Because let mommy, when she comes over, she'll bring some new flowers. Let her do it. So I do that for my children. You know, I keep their flower beds looking nice around their homes. I'm not doing a garden for them. They'll collect from me. So my carpenter said he would do it. It'll cost me less than what I would have paid to order the shed because you can order them and you just put them together. So anyway, I got his approval on that. So this summer I'll be showing my grandchildren how you grow your own things. So the food thing, you know, it's kind of ironic that Missouri would be the state to come out about they're going to make sure that their food is USDA when that state is so flooded out, they can't produce any meat. So, you know, to me, it's all a game to keep us fooled. Okay. You know, you're the state that has been underwater. I don't trust what you say. But anyway, back to Brother Jenna, I follow the finances and I follow anything, you know, that's changing. And something as a race of people, what happened to us? You touched on this a little bit, but I just want to put my smell on it and see what you think. Based on who your colonizer was, it's foretelling things down the century. Okay, like the islands. Who was your colonizer? I know my colonizer from my father's mom. They were French and Portuguese. Who your colonizer was made a lot of difference. Some of us had the British. Some had, you know, the British or whatever. But it does tell a story, and they are aware of all of this. Now, just recently, a couple of months ago, the state of North Carolina, where my dad was born, they put out the seven ports. After all of these umpteen years, they put out the seven ports where they brought slaves into. Now, they've been sitting on that information. Now you're putting it out. I do believe the best possible thing to help us is reparations. I don't see anything else. And that's, you know, where I'm putting my money and strength. I mean, it would make us a nation. It would address the brutality. It would, you know, and then the political corruption, you know, it's not just the continent, the motherland that has to experience that. We also. But anyway, those are the things I do. I watch the housing market. I mean, you know, that's what I do except for Saturdays and Sundays. I do Sunday dinner and I have my grandchildren on Saturday and Sunday. I don't do babysitting during the week because they need to be enhanced academically. You know, something parents don't do. You have to keep a kid busy. The stuff they're exposed to now in this society, in this day and age, my children weren't up against this kind of stuff. And then you have cell phones, you have the technology. So keep a kid active and tired. Yes, it is not it's not easy. It was very hard for us. On Saturdays, you run into this sports practice. You go in here. You got music on. It is. It's hard. I had the energy then, though, but it still has to be done. These guns in the schools with teachers. Number one, okay. I thought a lot of our people, or many people, were homeschooling now. Well, if you have a friend or a neighbor who's homeschooling, send your kid to their house. You have one or two laptops, and get homeschooled. They have to find a solution, because I'm not for teachers having guns. My grandchildren are not in these type of school systems, so it will not affect them. You're not going to tell Quakers what to do. It ain't never been like right. that. They had their own yep. thing. But I'm speaking for people that, I mean, I have a feeling about this. People that will be affected, I don't see any other recourse but homeschooling, and parents have to work. So therefore, if you have an at-home parent and if they're not homeschooling, then they need to start homeschooling and then have a couple of the kids in the neighborhood maybe come also to get the homeschooling. And so, because guns with teachers, absolutely. They don't pay these people enough money to even have that passion like they used to have or they should have. And, you know, it's a bizarro world. That's where we're going. Yeah. Everything's bizarro. It does seem like Matrix, as my children say. But I have a heart for the Gen Xers and the millennials, because I'm personally involved with that. I have nieces and nephews. You understand?
Yeah.
These people in my category who are not thinking about anyone, but they're just being an individual, or you're not taking it any further. Some of them not even think about their own. I'm trying to pass on wealth to my children and grands, because that's what was done for me. And you have to start someplace. There's many vehicles and things you can do, but the generations behind us, they're getting a raw deal, a very raw deal. And as a race of people, and if you're not a hater, it's awful. It's awful. And you did enough to us, you tried to do, and now this is what you're leaving for Gen Xers and millennials. Oh, heck no. I just told you, I'm a warrior. I don't walk with fear. You know, just you try to be decent. But, you know, we have responsibility as a people, and we shirk it a lot. But whatever I can share, I don't have a problem. As my mother was famous for saying, are you going to take the knowledge to your grave? Huh? So I heard that all my life. And that's why I am who I am. You know, the justice system, everything you're saying is on point. I have two attorneys in my family. My two first cousins are attorneys. They constantly tell, one of them used to tell me how he tells the brothers, look, man, this is, you going in here, they're not your friend. You thinking I can work a miracle? This is already set up against me, you know? So it's just, it's just horrible for us. Hopefully, Ados can do something, and just remember, everybody's not going to hear that drum. Everyone isn't, you know, and so people could do gardens. I'm just, you know, I can tell you everything. It's not hard. That's, you know, have something like that. You don't have to have a whole lot of ground, but we have to think about that. But I'm a mini prepper. You know, I started 2008, so the garden thing, I said, okay, let me do this again, because the grands, you know, I want them to have the same experiences we gave our children. And so I sacrificed to do this. The garden is work and it's money. And I have to do it even larger now, you know, because of the times we're living in. And so I want, you know, everyone that knows me or whatever, my family, to be able to take advantage of it. So I'm having an 8x8 built. So that way, and I walk in and I can take care. You open the door just like a chicken coop. So anyway, whatever that I can share or pass on, it's just, you know, you're on the right track. You know it. And if there's any things that, you know, someone older, a elder could tell you. I mean, there's many things that our people are not aware of. You know, my dad's cousin was a politician. He was Republican. He was also a funeral director. We had two funeral directors in our family, which
hey,
was
Ms.
what
Sharon.
He did.
Hey, Ms. Sharon, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate
yeah.
that. But we gonna,
oh, sure. Okay. So anyway, you know, you can, Brother Ross can always email me. I need to join that community. But as I said, I just don't feel I'm doing nothing anymore. But I'll let you go and keep up the good work, brother.
Oh, thank you, Miss Sharon.
Thank you very much,
ma'am.
Okay,
great
sure. Have a good night. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, too.
We was right here. Oh, where, Miss? Oh, she left. Okay. We was right here on this. Let's just start right here.
A one-of-a-kind manuscript written by a slave has now been preserved in the Library of Congress. The Arabic language autobiography spent decades in private collections before the library acquired it in 2017. Now it has been digitized for the world to read. And Amna Nawaz reports on the manuscript's remarkable journey for our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
Born and raised in West Africa, Omar Ibn Said was 37 years old when he was kidnapped and taken to America as a slave in the 1800s.
Before I came to the Christian country, my religion was the religion of Muhammad.
His autobiography, in his native language of Arabic, is believed to be the only one of its kind, the original words of a Muslim American slave.
Then there came to our place a large army who killed many men and took me and brought me to the Great Sea.
His literacy and culture completely goes against, abolishes, one might say, annihilates the narrative that slaves were not capable of culture. In fact, they were persons with distinct histories, abilities, culture, and background.
Ala al-Rayes has studied and translated the words of Omar ibn Said.
They sold me into the hands of the Christians, who bound me and sent me on board a great ship, and we sailed upon the Great Sea a month and a half, when we came to a place called Charleston.
He was wealthy, and he was highly educated, because in his autobiography he speaks about spending 25 years studying.
Mary Jane Deeb is the chief of the African and Middle East Division at the Library of Congress, where Ibn Said's manuscript now lives.
So there was a man who was caught at the age of 37, you know, and shipped off to South Carolina, in a country he doesn't know, among people whose language he doesn't know.
Ibn Said wrote he was sold to a, quote, small, weak, and wicked man called Johnson. After years of abuse, he fled, but was caught in North Carolina.
He is then captured and brought to a jail cell, and he begins to write on the walls of his jail cell in Arabic. So that attracted attention of pretty important people, because the man who ends up buying him and releasing him from jail was the brother of the governor of North Carolina.
Over time, Ibn Said converted to Christianity. In his 60s, he wrote his own story, but only in Arabic.
It's written in Arabic, and so his masters could not really read it at all. They could not really influence its writing. And so it was really his exact words, unfiltered by the machinery of the editorship of masters and abolitionists, as other slave narratives were.
A machinery, Al-Rayes says, erased countless narratives, including the fact that up to 20% of Africans enslaved in America were Muslim. Ibn Said, in fact, chose to open his autobiography with a verse from the Quran.
The crux of this Quranic chapter is that it's only God who has the possession and the ownership both of human beings and of things. And therefore, it seems to me a kind of a hidden text. What Omar is saying is that you guys have no right to own me here.
It's a narrative that challenges the original concept of who the slaves were when they came here. They didn't really have a system of belief. They were uncultured. They didn't have a written system. This is what he brings to the table and basically says that is who we really are.
But before those pages written by Omar ibn Said could be shared with the rest of the world, conservators here at the Library of Congress worked for months behind the scenes to bring those pages back to life.
We're trying to present the item as close to what it looked like at the time as possible.
Sylvia Albro led the effort to rescue the nearly 200-year-old manuscript. The materials themselves, she says, tell us even more about the life of Omar ibn Said.
It's actually surprising that the quality of paper for his manuscript is really pretty good. The fact that he had at his disposal good quality materials is an indication of the respect that he had as a figure, even as a slave.
That respect brought Ibn Said to the attention of prominent abolitionists, missionaries, and linguists at the time, who translated his story and used it in their fight against slavery. The entire manuscript is now available online for a new generation to read Ibn Said's words for themselves. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz in Washington, D.C.
And what a gift it is to all of us.
Before we get into it, I want you to play the Wood Harris one. And that's short. Only play it up to exactly minute 7. And you can stop it at 7 on the dot. Because they're kind of related.
Which one is that? Oh, okay, I got you. To 7?
It's the last one. Yeah, minute 7. You can start it from the beginning, stop at minute 7.
So then you get on the wire. I'll be honest. The one thing that fucked with me at one point was watching an interview with Idris and realizing that he's British. And I'm like, this motherfucker is not American? Like, are you kidding right now? And then McNulty,
not American,
is British as well.
British. A lot of the HBO actors too. If you even to look at Empire, Boardwalk Empire.
Huh.
Al Capone, British.
Oh, really?
The guy who played Capone in it. It's like 3 or 4 British actors. Yeah, they're British.
Yo, man, and these British guys are taking all our roles, man. Trump needs to do something about the British actors, man. That's what he needs to do.
Brexit the actors. They deserve the roles because...
No, I mean, they're obviously great actors.
Better, not just great, they're often better because... my theory on it is that they grow up with Shakespeare from day one.
Right.
So they grow up with... a poetry in their life that we don't, and also black people here in Europe, black people, society has a historical sensibility that associates with the African contribution to Europe. So you know, Europe wouldn't have written language and bathhouses and roads or this idea of schools and university. That's African stuff.
Hmm.
And Rome, Spain and Greece, those places are African civilized places. They made civilized by the Moors who came in 711 in Spain and stayed there hundreds of years. And they ended up with, prior to that though, not having numbers, a sense of what a number was, or written language. So I'm saying all that to say that in European history, they have that. In America, they pretty much don't give you the real story at all. So you're slaves and masters. You see, it's a big difference. It makes the black Americans grow up with a built-in inferiority switch that is always in the shadows, if you really believe you come from slavery. There's a lot of questions to be had about all of that. Lots of black people don't come from a slave background but don't know it. We all believe we come from one giant slave, you dig? Or from some plantation. While in Europe, the European black people associate with Africa.
Africa, yeah.
We over here, we found ourselves disassociating with it. When I was young, it was bad to be, you look African, or you know, those were bad things to say. Meanwhile, we didn't know, oh, my cousin was Cleopatra.
Hmm.
You dig? Something empowering so that the inferiority switch don't just turn on when you come out the house and a white cop drives by. Or you feel like you're walking through a Walgreens. Imagine you're walking through a store that everybody walks through casually and has no sentiment at all but for what they want to buy, but you feel like they think you're going to steal.
Yeah.
So that is a heartbreak, dog. I mean, our culture is pretty much a heartbroken culture with no therapy at this point. And I just think that there's not a lot of compassion for the weak spots in the culture. You see the strong spots because we got the Ali and the LeBron and the Jordan and that. You see all these and you see all this bravado, but now you even see money in the young people. Jay-Z got $1 billion and Dr. Dre got $1 billion and these cats have billions. So we're not being associated with, as a group, culturally speaking, Black American ethnic culture group is, like I said, it's pretty heartbroken and money can't fix that. And there's no therapy. It used to be church, but it's not so therapeutic because of money and things. So I think that, I mean, I'm getting to this point, but I think that, and it's a long road with a lot that I said, but I just think that European talent, white and Black, because white people over here think masters. They think opposite of slaves. So they end up with a superiority switch to click on. You know, the freedom or entitlement sort of thing. Well, I'm entitled to that. And it's not because you're thinking, oh, I'm white and I'm entitled to it. You just have it in the DNA now. It's just in the edifice of our own design. It's in the edifice of our American design. Energy is oozing through us to be that way. I just think the European actors have early poetry of Shakespeare, truthful history that's empowering and not as weakening. Idris is empowered by that. All of the talents are empowered by it, white or Black European talent, because they just know the truth.
Yeah,
they come over with more of the truth. And so with that out the way, now they got the truth. Now they can go play act better than me because I got the inferiority switch that needs to be, that needs therapy in a sense. You know, when I say I mean we, Americans, Black or white, we have switches that are in the DNA that belong to 100 years of bullshit that never got therapy or cleared up or truthfully told to us. If you don't go find your own truth in America, you will not grow up with the truth unless you, your dad gave it to you or your mom gave it to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I mentioned this in some of my other interviews. I remember the first time I went to Africa. I went to Senegal, and I wasn't born in this country. I was born in what used to be Russia. Now it's the Ukraine, but I grew up in America since I was 5 years old. And it wasn't until I went to Africa and I started to walk around that I started to realize that there was no tension between races in Africa. And I just always assumed in my head that that was a genetic thing. People look differently, so they're going to act differently towards each other. And it suddenly clicked that I'm like, oh, this is an American thing.
Absolutely.
That this whole, you know, slavery was not that long ago, and there's still repercussions of this. But when you go to Senegal,
yeah,
there's none of that.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? So everyone's looking at you smiling like you're one of them, and it's like, oh, okay, this is the American bullshit. I finally see it. I really, everyone who's listening to this, really, you guys need to travel to really understand.
You do need to travel.
Where you live, too. Yeah. Because if you just stay where you are, you're never going to figure it out.
You're never going to figure it out.
Yeah. And
there we go. Thank you for playing that. Now, it's powerful for me because he's talking about epigenetics, something I talked about. I said Black people are automatically born after 500 years of all of this stuff with no therapy. A lot of Black people are automatically born, especially Black males, to accept an inferior position in society automatically. It's in the DNA. And white children are born automatically thinking I'm the superior to everybody. So, I mean, I've personally seen in New York City affluent white children with Latino or African or Caribbean caregivers, and they will dominate their adult caregivers because they know their position in society even at 5, 6 years old. So he just described that. He just didn't describe it using that that terminology, but he's talking about there's that automatic inferiority chip that kicks in, and you always have to compensate for it. You're never free to completely explore the fullness of your humanity, even as an actor, he's saying. That there's always that little thing back there needling at you that, darn, I don't have it. I may not be able to do it. And it's because we live in a society, like you said, it's a society that is no therapy, but we're heartbroken. There's generations of heartbroken people. And that specifically applies to American Africans, the narrative, his admonition of travel. I've heard a few American Africans say, oh, I got everything I need here in America, and I'm not going anyplace else. And they both, and we know that Vlad practiced some racism in that video. I'm not going to even focus on that, but he did. Yeah. But ultimately, the education that you get from being on the ground someplace else and seeing how people live versus what you may read in the textbook or you may hear other people talk about is something that is priceless, especially when it comes to traveling on the African continent or even going to other parts of the world. But for Black people going to the African continent, there's so much misinformation about the people, the society, and their love or lack thereof for American Africans or diasporan Africans. A lot of that stuff is lies, and it will only take you going there and having experiences there for it to make sense and for you to really learn, like they said, the truth. With that travel will come more of the truth, because a lot of other places aren't as suppressed and oppressed as far as correct education as we are over here. We've just been lied to and told that America is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and we really believe it. And then you go to places on the continent and there's no practice of white supremacy on you, because there's no white people. And people are greeting you first thing in the morning. And people are not rich, but they're happy with their existence. You don't have to worry about somebody knocking you over the head and trying to rob you or trying to sell drugs to you. None of that is happening there in places when you travel and you get to have those down home on the ground experiences. And there's a lot of stuff that you don't realize that we carry, like you said, all the time. And it's almost like a pain that you get used to. You just think that this is my life. I'm used to this pain. It's always been there, almost like a crutch. So without that pain, you feel abnormal to be pain-free. And then you get to a society where there's a semblance of pain-freeness in regards to your daily reality. There's no pressure of when I go to the store, somebody's following me around everywhere, thinking I'm going to steal. None of that's happening to you. So you actually get to live a more holistically human existence, because you're in a country with your own people that look like you, and they're happy to see you. They're happy to see you. It's not like when you might get on a bus here and somebody's mean mugging you from across the aisle on the bus the whole trip. Because they look like you, but they're mean mugging you because things are so terrible for them, mm-hmm. and they don't know how to deal with it, so they're projecting it. And then if you look at them too long, what you looking at? Then it starts a whole nother thing depending on your response to that.
You look like a victim.
Those things aren't happening to you. Go ahead.
You look like a victim to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, again, it's that chip, because we know that our lives are worth less. So if I can dominate another Black person and abuse them, I'm very likely of potentially getting away with that crime that I know I would never get away with if I did it to a white person.
Yeah, hey.
So it makes you... Go ahead.
Roz, we done ran out of time. Let's get to this ancestor reverence. I know you wanted to get to this.
No, I want to do that next week, because we don't have enough time to get into that. But that's the surprise, one of the surprises that we were going to talk about. We're going to end up starting with it next week. But we're going to get into ancestral reverence, and building an ancestral shrine or sacred space in your home, and the nuanced basics of that, and just give an insight to what that is, because a lot of people have wrong information about, they call it ancestral worship and things like that, and it's really a relationship between yourself and those of your people that have passed on. And
Like the little animated movie Coco.
Yes, that's a good example of it in the Mexican way that it's practiced. And it's weird, because that same Day of the Dead that they celebrate, we celebrate that in Trinidad too. That is a day that we celebrate, not with some of the fanfare that you find in Mexico, but it is an ancestral day that we provide that and spend paying homage to our ancestors. That's just something that I've always known about. And there's a lot of ways that we do that, but the significance of it is extremely important. And for those who have been interested in that, especially I know when I was doing the conversations on Lance Skirvin and stuff, there's a lot of people who are transitioning in that direction as far as getting that understanding of the importance of the ancestors and the role that they play. And they wanted more information about how to do that, you know, and also about ancestral sacred spaces and how to go about creating one and taking care of that space, because it's a relationship. It's like a contractual relationship. It's like any other relationship. It's just that those particular people are people who are no longer in the flesh, but they're still there. So you treat and respect them with that same reverence as if they still have flesh and blood. And that's pretty much what it is. And there's things that you do to further facilitate that relationship. And then what you find is that you'll start to have certain experiences in your life and certain things where they take care of you. And they might even make themselves known to you very, very plainly. And there's a lot of ways that ancestors attempt to do it and a lot of ways that they actually do it. And depending on the person and how in tune they are, and whether or not they fear the dead, because some people are really scared of anything to do with the dead. And if they are making an attempt to communicate with you, they always try to find a way that's non-shocking or scary for you. They don't ever want to present themselves in a way that is something that you're going to run from, because they need you, just like you need them. So they try to come to you in a way that is most pleasing. That doesn't create a situation with anxiety or high stress or fear or that sort of thing. And a lot of the religions that we practice, those of us who practice Western religion in particular, a lot of it is based on fear of the deity, and in a lot of ways, lack of an ancestral systemic practice. So you have some variants of Western religion where they are incorporated an ancestral side, but it's not something that is a core practice of the tradition itself. It is something that they're bringing culturally. So like in Africa, you might have a Christian, but they still will practice some form of ancestral reverence because that is an African cultural thing. It's not something that comes with Christianity as a religion. So it all depends. And, you know, for those who are interested in that, we're going to get into that and just give some context to it. And also there's some great books that that I can suggest that will get into some of this stuff. In regards to building an ancestral space, and some of them have good ancestral prayers, and just even life stories of people and how the ancestors interplay in their lives. And they actually, these are real life stories of real people written in their books about their own experiences, and the stuff that I think will really shift people's understanding of who and what the ancestors are, how they, the role they play in our lives, and a lot of the abilities that we used to have that a lot of us don't have because we don't have these cultural connections anymore, especially when it comes to African traditional religion. And there's a lot of things that we're missing. We're not whole people, because there's whole pieces of who we are that are completely exorcised from our existence and has been for generations. So this ancestral reverence thing is a way of reconnecting to one part of that, and hopefully it'll help some people. That's really what the conversation is about, is for those people who are interested and want to know more about it, and may just be taking their first step in that direction to wanting to establish that kind of a sacred space and communication. And we'll be talking about it next week. And there's a couple of these other things we didn't get to that we will, but we're going to definitely go into that next week. So for anyone who is interested in that, then next week will be a good show to tune into. Did you have anything you wanted to say, Jenna?
No, you covered everything. Appreciate Ms. Sharon for sharing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I agree with you emphatically. And I did want to say one thing about the first video about Omar Saeed. I think it's really great to hear a narrative of an enslaved person from their own hands and them telling you where they're from, and telling you their story and the differences, and the fact that when you see how he identified them as Christian. He didn't identify them from a country. He identified them by their religion. And that was because he came from a place and space that practiced Islam, and these people were Christians, and they enslaved him. And even through that, he was able to convey his humanity, even though he did it in Arabic and the people couldn't understand it. And even though he converted to Christianity, he wrote his entire narrative in Arabic, and the first thing he did was he quoted the Quran. So I'm pretty sure that there was a syncretization for him of Islam that he incorporated in Christianity, just based on those little signs alone. You don't start as a Christian a book about your life with a verse from the Quran unless you're still practicing Islam in some capacity. And then you're writing an entire text, not in English, but in Arabic, your native tongue that you brought with you from Africa. So what it's telling me is that I'm pretty sure he incorporated those African traditional aspects of Islam that he brought with him in his Christian practice, the same way that the slaves from Yoruba land in Puerto Rico created Santeria, which is a syncretic Christian Ifa tradition. Or in Cuba, you had Lukumi, which is the Christian syncretic tradition with the Ifa tradition. Or you go to Brazil and you have Candomblé, which is the melding of the Christian tradition with the Orisha tradition of the Yoruba people. And then in Trinidad, we used to call them Shango Baptists, but they changed their name in recent years to the Orisha tradition of Trinidad and Tobago, where they did the same thing. It was originally a syncretized religion, and today they've broken away from Christianity and strictly practice the African tradition holistically now. So these are the things we'll get into. So those who are interested, we're going to get into that next week. Hopefully it'll be something that's really helpful for folks, and they'll be able to get a better understanding, because there's a lot of times ancestors communicate with us, and if we're not of a tradition, family tradition that recognizes that, there could be tons of signs you've been getting your whole life, and you just weren't in tune to those signs. So it's just like speaking a language someone doesn't understand. They might have been trying to get your attention for years, and you just didn't know what it was, and you were just living your life, you know, your daily reality, and it didn't include them, so you didn't see the signs and the messages that were being conveyed to you. So real interesting stuff. But yeah, we're going to get into that next week, and I know it's time for us to close out, so we're going to do that now. I'll say the prayer and we'll shut it down. Creator willing. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times and all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Let's replace white supremacy with justice ASAP, and let's end the prison industrial complex and human trafficking as well. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. And always remember the African proverb, if there are no enemies within, the enemies without can do little harm. Again, thank you for spending your Tuesday evening with us. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you, and thank you all. Thank you, Sister Sharon, for your input. Thank you for the other calls and listeners, and for those who may listen to the podcast at some other time. We will see you again next week, Tuesday. And have a wonderful night. Stay out of the grasp of race soldiers. Stay safe. Make codified decisions that protect you and your loved ones from any sort of contact with race soldiers or racists if you can help it. And stay codified and practice Black self-respect. We'll see you again next Tuesday. Peace and love. One love to you all, and we'll see you again next week. Creator One. Peace.
Notice the tactics they approaching you with. Sure. Night, peace.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree.